Committee on Energy to order. The time is approximately 3:05. Today is February 2nd, 2010. Present at the table are Vice Chair Johansson, Co-Chair Millett, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Peterson, myself, Co-Chair Edgman. The purpose of today's meeting is to bring up House Bill 306, which is energy policy legislation for the purposes of entertaining Amendment Number 5. It's the Chair's intention at that time to take a vote on moving the bill out of committee, at least bring that before the committee. Item number two will be to get a presentation from Tony Palmer with TransCanada regarding the GEA gas pipeline project in the open season, a presentation that was made to the Senate committee, I believe it was yesterday, as well as the House Resources Committee. So we'd also like to remind everyone, as we do every meeting, to please silence your cell phones. And not seeing any comments from committee members, Representative Johansson, do you want to move Amendment Number 5, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment Number 5.
And for discussion purposes, I'll object. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Page 2, line 22, following export, simply inserts of power that is surplus to the needs of Alaska communities. This relates to, it follows the line 19, encourage economic development by A, promoting the development of renewable energy sources, including geothermal, wind, solar, hydroelectric, hydrokinetic, tidal, and biomass energy for use by Alaskans and for export. So basically the amendment says as soon as we take care of ourselves with these types of energy listed, then we can export. And I want to make sure we take care of Alaskans first. And after that, we're free to export onto the national grid if we're ever connected to it. That's simply what it is. And I'd ask the support of the rest of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Johansson. Discussion committee members? Not seeing any discussion and no objection, I'll remove my objection. And Amendment Number 5 will be adopted. We now have the bill up before us. What's the will of the committee?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 306 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
And not hearing any objections, so moved. And we'll take a short break while we sign the document to do so. Do that. Next committee, we would now invite Mr. Palmer to please come to the table and begin the presentation on the gas pipeline project and the progress being made towards open season. Tony, it's always good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tony Palmer. I'm Vice President of Alaska Development for TransCanada. I'm also Chairman of the Management Committee of the Alaska Pipeline Project. I'm very pleased to be with you today and to provide you with this presentation. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I would introduce my colleagues that are with me today.
Please.
Directly behind me is Mr. Paul Pike. He's the Senior Project Manager for the Alaska Pipeline Project. He's an ExxonMobil employee. Next to Mr. Pike is Patty Golosky. She handles external affairs for the project, I think well known to the committee. And next to Patty is Mr. Jim Morse, who is Project Counsel, the Alaska Pipeline Project. He's also an ExxonMobil employee. Just to my immediate left is Tom Roberts. He handles DC matters for TransCanada and is also advisor to the Finance Committee for the Alaska Pipeline Project. And next to him is Mr. Brian Dumphy. He's the Public Affairs Manager for the project, also an ExxonMobil employee. So thank you for that indulgence. And with that, if you're ready, I'll commence my presentation.
And committee members, Mr. Palmer, you wouldn't mind taking questions as you present the slides?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be pleased to do so.
Okay, so we essentially have now until 5 o'clock when the committee normally concludes, but that by way of saying we have ample enough time to go through the presentation. So if you would begin, Mr. Palmer.
Thank you. I want to highlight for you materials that we presented. Submitted to FERC last Friday, the 29th of January. And I will tell you that these materials are on our website. In fact, the entire application sits on our website as well as FERC's website and has been there since Friday. So this is a historic moment for our company and ExxonMobil, and quite frankly, we think the project. This is the first open season that will be conducted for this project ever. And in an open season, the pipeline company provides potential customers with engineering information, commercial, tariffs, cost information, all available not just to our potential customers, but uniquely for this project because of FERC rules, also available to the public and, quite frankly, to our competitors. That has never occurred before in any FERC filing that I'm aware of. So those are unique rules as established by FERC. We have 700 or 800 pages of documentation that we filed on Friday. That's available to all parties, and I suspect our competitors spent Friday downloading that. So what are we looking for in the open season? What we're seeking, of course, are shippers' contractual commitments through executed precedent agreements, and I'll walk you through that as I go forward. I will spend very little time on the map, but I did want to highlight for folks, because I know through representations I've received over the years that parties are interested in two alternatives, and that's exactly what we have presented. An alternative to serve Alaskan gas customers, of course, that applies to both options, but also to go to the lower 48 via Alberta, and secondly, to go to U.S. or international LNG markets via Valdez. And because I know you're very familiar with this map, I'll just flip to the next page. And I did want to highlight for you the stage the project is in today, and really the stages that major pipeline projects proceed through in order to finally go into operation. It is normal that large pipeline projects go through a lengthy development stage. That's the stage we're in today for this project. Then, if successful, we move to construction and finally to operations. We expect to be in the development stage for this project through 2014, as highlighted in the schedule that we put forward in the AGIA application. Prior to open season, which is the stage we're at today, through the end of April, we'll be prior to open season, assuming FERC acts expeditiously, and I'm confident they will, conduct the open season from May to July, just as we've said for more than 18 months now, and post-open season, still in development phase, from 2010 August through 2014, will continue through development. I also want to highlight for you, as I've said many times, no single commercial party can guarantee the success of this project. It's going to take the cooperation of the pipeline project, producers, other shippers, and governments, plural, to make this project a success. We each need to advance the project, and we each need to have commercial and regulatory breakthroughs. The pipeline project will do its part. You've seen that from us to date, and we'll continue to move that ball forward. However, other parties also need to act for this project to move out of development stage and into construction. So where are we today, and how did we get to this point? I want to give credit to other parties because there has been a great deal of work undertaken by a number of parties to get us to this point. Firstly, producers and shippers. Over the decades, really, producers have explored and developed gas reserves. You're very familiar with the numbers. There are proven gas reserves of 35 or 36 TCF on the North Slope, and there's significant other gas reserves. Those parties should be credited with the work they've done over time, acting not just in their own interest, but also in the interest of the state of Alaska to bring that forward. That's a very large advantage for this project relative to other development projects where there's a modest base gas. There are clearly some disadvantages for this project as well, but that's an advantage. Those potential customers have looked at transportation alternatives. They've examined where they want their gas to go in ultimate markets. Still have further work to do, but they should be credited for the work they've undertaken. Secondly, the state of Alaska. 3 years ago, this state, the administration, and the legislature defined your objectives for this project. And you did so under AGIA. And you've moved forward under Aegean. That's a significant accomplishment, we would argue. Certainly, the projects that I've been involved with and our company's been involved with, it's critical to have local support. And in fact, you've achieved that through the legislation you passed and the license you granted. I've heard no parties really in Alaska that are opposed to a project. They want to see development for Alaska Gas. That's positive. I know there are parties that have different views as to how we proceed. But clearly, that's a critical requirement for any project. We've seen projects that have had federal approval, that have had customers, and with local opposition, they fail. And those are not just projects from 30 years ago. They're current projects. So local support for the project, state support for the project is critical. Just to continue, state, of course, granted us the Aegean license in the fall of 2008, and we understand that the administration continues to move forward on the royalty regulations that are set out in Aegean, just part of the legislation. They're moving forward to put those regs in place. So I want to applaud the initiatives of the U.S. government and FERC, because once again, they have established a unique regulatory structure for this project. A single window regulatory agency, a specific time frame to process an application. They deserve credit for that. They've also put in place a federal loan guarantee. If we go back to 30 years ago on this project, a federal loan guarantee would have been very helpful for the project. I don't say decisive, but that was not in place at the time and certainly is a large benefit for the project as we move forward. They've established the FERC regulatory process, which we've kicked off the process in comprehensive detail on Friday. We had pre-filed earlier in 2009. Secondly, and lastly on this page, the Canadian government has also established the regulatory and legislative structure for this project, the Northern Pipeline Act, specific piece of legislation available to our project. That's also provides a single window regulatory agency for the project. And I perhaps should just take a moment now to address why that's important for the project. I've said for many years that in order for any project to succeed, the project needs customers and you need regulatory approvals. One of those does not make a successful project. And if you want a couple of examples, just look at this project 30 years ago. We had all the regulatory approvals for the project on both sides of the border 30 years ago. We had no customers. The project did not proceed. 7 years ago, in 2003, the Mackenzie project had all its customers. So recall that that was 7 years ago. Today, we're looking to go forward with an open season here this year. 7 years ago, they had their customers. They made their application under the National Energy Board in October of 2004. They're hoping to get a regulatory approval this fall, 6 years after they made that application. By the way, I will tell you, that's the regulatory process that any other project for Alaska Gas than ours will go through in Canada. I think you will have heard from Canadian officials and other parties that they would hope to do better next time in terms of pace, but there's no legislation other than ours to expedite a project. And we hold an NEB certificate for that project already through Canada.
A question, Co-Chair Millett.
Hi, it's good to see you again. Thank you for being here. You mentioned two things that need to be in alignment, regulatory and what was the other?
Commercial.
Commercial. Can I ask you, is there a third one that's missing from this project that you think may stymie the open season process?
Co-Chair Millett, through the chair, I will tell you that you will see as I go through this presentation, there are roles for all players, governments, shippers, and the pipeline company to align. I've described to you what the pipeline company needs really to attract customers. Behind what customers may need, you may find that they need actions by governments, if that's what you're leading me to. I'd be happy. I am going to address that as we go through. If you want me to, I can have a go at it now.
No, I through the chair. It's interesting. You're the pipeline company, but I think that you also understand that for your open season to be successful, the government does need to get involved. So I would suggest that we aren't aligned yet for for you as a pipeline company, we're missing the third fiscal terms, basically, is what we're missing. And so I know you're going to talk about it later, but I just, you know, to say that, you know, the pipeline company has all it needs to this point, I feel that that's probably, I mean, you need fiscal terms for people to commit their gas. So, I mean, you'll for the pipeline company to go forward, it's great, but you don't have a pipeline without shippers, and you don't have shippers without fiscal terms. So I guess the equation in my terms is still that the third wheel is missing, or the third leg is missing.
Co-chair Mellett, through the chair, you'll see that that's fundamental part of my charts that are coming up. And so we agree that other parties like governments and shippers need to take actions as well, or we can't succeed. We'll do what we can to advance the project, but we're not a party to any matters like fiscal that you describe. Mm-hmm. We're certainly encouraged shippers and governments to resolve those matters, but that's in your hands as a sovereign, not in ours as a pipeline company.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the Mackenzie Delta project, and you said that they had spent 6 years or more trying to get their approval to build through Canada, and this project already has that approval. So does that mean that the Alaska pipeline has moved ahead of the Mackenzie Delta pipeline?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, I would say that they are at different stages. That project has customers and is seeking regulatory approvals, and I think would hope that they receive them later this year. This project in Canada already has a National Energy Board certificate. We need to obtain a FERC certificate, and we need to attract customers. So it's difficult to say where things are in terms of timing. At present, I think Mackenzie Valley Project has indicated they will be in service before the dates we've described. But I've said many times, and I'll continue to repeat here today, that the success of both projects rely on regulatory and commercial breakthroughs on each project. They are on independent tracks, and in our view, both are needed in the marketplace. And lastly, I'll highlight that we have held a right-of-way through the Yukon since 1983. We think that's a significant asset for the project. So what have we done as a project to bring us to this point? I've also said for several years that we think the best and most effective way to advance the project and complete the project is an alignment of five parties, three North Slope producers, TransCanada, and the state of Alaska. We believe that we're aligned with the state under the AGIA license that was granted to us in 2008. You'll recall that TransCanada and ExxonMobil aligned in the summer of 2009 to advance the project. I indicated in our AGIA application 2 years ago that we were prepared to offer equity participation to major parties that significantly commit gas in that initial open season. And I've said publicly, and every time I've spoken since that time, that we're happy to offer equity participation to BP and Conoco. I will tell you that to date, no concrete negotiations have been undertaken to effect that. That offer is outstanding, and we'll continue to make that. That's supported not just by TransCanada, but by ExxonMobil as well. So we would like to see that alignment occur. At the request of FERC and some other parties, we did initiate the FERC pre-filing process in 2009. We've continued to interface with the Northern Pipeline Agency in Canada. That's the counterpart to the Office of the Federal Coordinator in the United States. We've commenced negotiations with First Nations in Canada, had good interfaces with Alaska Native groups and communities along the project corridor in Alaska. The next bullet highlights something that I think I've identified for this committee, and I know that there were parties that were concerned about in the past, and I think the item that they were concerned about was the withdrawn partner claims on the previous project. There were parties that thought that that would delay the project or potentially prevent it from proceeding. I've advised you, I think, before that all of those claims have been resolved at no cost to TransCanada, and that old partnership has been dissolved. So anyone that was concerned about that in the past, it is now gone entirely. We've also developed comprehensive Alberta and LNG alternatives. We had parties that were concerned that we would not do so for the LNG. You will see, if you examine our materials, we've done a comprehensive LNG alternative. It's available to any party. Customers will make that choice in the initial open season, whether they want to deliver to Alaskan communities, to Valdez, or to Alberta on the way to the lower 48. We filed the open season plan. I won't repeat that. And the last bullet on the page really addresses an in-state gas study. That was a requirement of FERC in order to apply for the open season plan. We had to have completed an in-state gas study or have another version available to us. That was undertaken by an independent group led by Northern Economics with ICER as well as another consulting firm. They've completed that study. It's on the FERC website. It's on our website. It's available. I will tell you what we used it for, because it was a requirement of FERC that we complete it. It was used for indicative offtakes or delivery points from the pipeline, and it was secondly used for indicative tolls for in-state gas. There will be a technical conference in Anchorage at the Anchorage Marriott this Thursday, so tomorrow at 2 p.m., and there will be a call-in arrangement for parties that are unable to attend in person. They can call in and listen to that tomorrow afternoon. I will be there as well, but I will tell you it's primarily Northern Economics and their colleagues reviewing their numbers and how they derived it comprehensively. That technical conference will go for 2 or 2.5 hours tomorrow afternoon. So if you or your staff are interested, I think that there was a letter came to your offices advising you of that and how to make that contact. And there's a media advisory went out earlier today. On slide six, I'll quickly walk you through the timeline. The filing on Friday begins a 60-day FERC review for the U.S. section. If FERC approves that plan, you'll see in that timeline below, we expect the public comment period to continue through the majority of February. In fact, I think they've now defined it through February 24th. The applicant, the Alaska Pipeline Project, will have an opportunity to respond then for a couple of weeks, and then we expect FERC to make that decision by the end of March. If they do so, based on what we filed, and I expect that that will be the case, because this review is primarily procedural. They're not making comments on the quality of our commercial offering or our capital cost estimate. They're really checking the boxes to see if we've completed the plan as expected. Our staff have met a couple of times with FERC staff, so I'm confident that we will achieve that. But we can always be surprised. It's clearly their prerogative to say yay or nay.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, a pleasure to see you. Godspeed to TransCanada in your effort to help us monetize our gas. I'm very encouraged by the work that you've put together so far. It's a pleasure to have you here. Question, when does the state's participation shift from 50-50 to 90-10 for reimbursement? On this slide, we see the different from the open season planning through this whole period. At what point is the state obligated to the 90-10 relationship?
Thank you, Representative Ramos, to the chair. If you look at this slide and you assume that FERC does act on a timely basis, and we're confident they will, we will be conducting the open season from May through the end of July. Mm-hmm. And so prior to the end of July, the state will reimburse us for prudently incurred costs up to 50%. And post the open season, so August the 1st, they would reimburse us for 90% of prudently incurred costs within the AGIA structure, until you hit the $500 million cap. You know that your obligation is capped and the obligations of the sponsors are not.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramos.
So, Tony, question. We're all encouraged by where this is at. We're delighted with to have Exxon assisting to whatever extent with the gas conditioning plant and some of the engineering increment. It's nice to see you bring a unique professionalism that we all highly regard. Like many of the members around this table, I'm very interested in my state building schools, buying ambulances and fire trucks, If the state were to terminate AGIA and ask TransCanada to participate, given that we have this much invested in it, what would be the posture of TransCanada? Would it move forward in developing this project, or is it still contingent on state participation at the 90% level after July? I mean, we've all had a pretty good look-see. Looks pretty good. Your statement certainly suggests that it is, that we should all be encouraged. We sure would like to see the playing field leveled. And where is TransCanada postured on that right now?
Representative Ramos, through the chair, you ask a highly complex question. I know you understand that very much. We made an application under a statute, the AGIA statute. We followed the rules as set down by the state. Those rules established, if we were granted the license, some obligations mm-hmm. of TransCanada and some rights for TransCanada. We do not possess the right to unilaterally change the deal, and we don't think the state does either. So if the state decides that it does not want to proceed, then we would look to the process that you're going to use with us to terminate any arrangement. When we undertook the obligations, we think we were very careful to understand what they were, and we think that to date we have met them all, and we're confident that we'll continue to do so. And I think I would say that the state of Alaska has also met all our obligations to TransCanada. We're pleased with the relationship we have with you. If the state decides that it wants to go a different direction, I presume they would have discussions with us as to how they would go about doing so.
Follow up, Chair. Representative Ramos.
So, Tony, we all want the same thing. Your remarks were quite appropriate. Everybody at this table, in this building, in this state, that wants a large diameter gas pipeline. And furthermore, more specifically, we all, I believe, want all five parties to sit down together. We'd all be benefited by having the three producers, the state of Alaska and TransCanada, sit down together and discuss this. What would TransCanada do if the state terminated its obligations under AGIA in order to foster an opportunity for all five parties to sit down? Would TransCanada be interested in continuing its work, or would it walk away from the transaction and decide that the state was not a good faith, had not been a good faith partner, even though the objective of putting all five parties together at a table still would remain, and the state would be able to use its money to go build roads, schools, and buy ambulances and fire trucks? TransCanada still would have a lot of intellectual property. The five entities would still remain, and there would still be a great willingness to build and go forward with a single project, and we all would be more knowledgeable having gone through an open season for TransCanada through the AGIA process, and then very likely by that time an open season with Denali as well.
Representative Ramos, through the chair, every time I hear someone talk about a level playing field, sir, I always like to check my pockets. And the reason for that is, let's talk about the level playing field. In 2007, you passed the statute. The legislature did so after the recommendation of the administration. You then established an RFP process that was available to all comers. We decided to participate in that. That was a level playing field. We were reviewed extensively by the administration and the legislature. And in fact, we filed comprehensive documents in a very transparent fashion, in fact, in a structure that I have never gone through before, where we revealed to our competitors huge amounts of information. Our competitors have never done so to date. Secondly, we committed to a schedule, which we're following through with today, last Friday, and we'll continue to do that. We've also presented massive amounts of information to the state on an ongoing basis. They've had monitors that continue to examine what we're doing, and that's as they should have that opportunity under AGEA because they have rights and we have rights. Our competitors have not gone through any of that review. At the same time, we've also offered equity participation to the sponsors of our competitor at any time. To date, they've chosen not to take that up. So starting, and I'll also tell you, because of the schedule we have, I'll make an analogy. If you choose to have someone construct a deck on the back of your house and you let contracts to parties, you would normally, as the customer, examine all those contracts. But the competitors would not see the other bids. In this circumstance, because of the schedule that we're on, we've made the bid and you've shown that bid to all of our competitors. It's available to them today. Now, I understand that's not the AGEA process, that is the FERC process. But the schedule we're on have allowed our competitors to, in effect, see all of our books, see our entire proposal today. That's an unusual circumstance. So when you talk about a level playing field and starting over, I would suggest to you it's not a level playing field. We have undertaken obligations to the state and met them, as you have. Starting over today is not a level playing field in our view. But if the state makes a decision to go a different direction, I presume they'll have discussions with TransCanada as to how they'll proceed.
Mr. Chair, just and it doesn't require a lengthy response, and I didn't mean for it to be a complex question. What would TransCanada do if the state opted to terminate its relationship with AGEA? Would you walk away from the project, or is it still appealing, given that you appealed so many layers of the onion back and have expressed a great deal of confidence in the ability to build out a program? I mean, I think a lot of us are just looking for some common ground rather than either one or two Gordian knots, which is how many of us regard the situation right now. So my question, I withdraw the remark about a level playing field. My interest is in what posture would TransCanada take if the state withdrew from AGEA. Would TransCanada still be interested in this project if it was going forward with its own dough?
Representative Ramirez, through the chair, there are circumstances under which either party can withdraw. There are circumstances in AGEA that allow that to happen, specific circumstances, other circumstances where there's either defined or undefined penalties for the party that withdraws.
Indeed.
TransCanada has not made any decision as to what it would do in that circumstance because, quite frankly, we have not contemplated it. We intend to meet our obligations to the state, and we're satisfied that to date the state has done the same. If you decide to go a different way, we'll clearly have to analyze the situation at that time, but I'm not going to address a hypothetical question for you today and give you that response.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions at this point? If not, Mr. Palmer?
I'm one of our people made a clarification for me so that I understand. I misspoke on the previous slide. I indicated the technical conference is tomorrow. That's incorrect. February the 4th is Thursday. Sorry if I provided people with false information there. On slide six, I'll just quickly go through it. The open season in Alaska will continue concurrently with the Canadian open seasons for service to the Alberta Hub in the event that the Alberta option is something customers want to look at. I will tell you that subsequent to that, I would expect if we get conditioned bids, and that's the most likely case, typical situation, we will take the remainder of this year to review those conditions, try to resolve them between the pipeline company and the shippers. And I'll just repeat what I said in other committees because I've been asked a number of times in the last week whether or not this time frame to resolve condition bids is somehow related to the political schedule. And I want to assure you that's not the case. When we made our application in the fall of 2007, we had indicated that if we received condition bids, we would take approximately 100 business days, five calendar months, to review and resolve condition bids. At that time, you may or may not recall that we had a schedule where the open season would have concluded in September of 2009. 5 months later would take us to this month. Clearly, nothing to do with the political schedule. because we filed in the fall of 2007, we had to anticipate a start date for our schedule. We did so, and we had hoped that we would receive the license by April of 2008. Both the administration and the legislature took a little longer to do the review. In fact, as I recall, the administration recommended to the legislature in May of 2008. You did an extensive review, and the license was granted in December. That meant we changed the schedule. You'll recall that occurred in the summer of 2008, and the open season now concludes at the end of July, and the 100 business days does take you through the political schedule, but I assure you it had nothing to do with political motivations on the behalf of TransCanada or the Alaska Pipeline Project. The 100 business days has been there for more than 2 years. If, on the other hand, we get no bids or totally unconditioned bids, we're clearly not going to take 5 months to reveal what the results are. But the expectation is we will get conditions, and if we do, we'll do what we do in any normal open season, is we're going to work with those customers in confidence to try to resolve those conditions.
Question, Co-Chair Miller?
Yeah. And Tony, maybe you can help me remember. What, under the AGIA agreement, the license, you guys have a regulated rate of return? You have a guaranteed rate of return? Is that correct?
Co-Chair Miller, through the chair, I always have to be careful as to how we define the rate of return. We would have a regulated rate of return, not a guaranteed rate of return.
And the regulated rate of return is
Co-Chair Millett, through the chair, I'm going to come to that. In fact, I'll reveal to you that we've actually made a better offer on the table. But our G application had a formulaic approach for return on equity, which when we filed would have yielded a 14% return on equity. You'll see later in the presentation, you'll see that we're now offering for customers that commit in the initial open season a 12% rate of return. So we're in effect taking a lower return as an inducement for parties to commit to the project this summer. You'll see some other items as well as I go forward.
Follow up. And okay. Is that reduction in rate of return does the shale play have any? Are you concerned about shale? I mean, your partner just bought up XTO, which makes them one of the largest shale holders. I would think pretty close to a big natural, you know. They have a large holding of natural gas. So is your reduction in the rate of return based on maybe more competitive market now that shales become so?
Co-Chair Millett, through the chair, you'll see, and I'll highlight that for you later, but I'll respond to your question now, is that there is no question that the world has changed somewhat since the summer of 2008. At that time, oil prices were very high. Gas prices were also extremely high. We've faced an epic financial crisis across the world, particularly in North America, since that time. Shale gas is a new player, a much more significant player than it was 2 years ago. And we have competition in all marketplaces for not just this project, but this project moving Alaska gas to markets in the lower 48 or global markets. So yes, we have responded to competition, not just one item being shale gas, but all of these components. We've responded and we've put forward a more competitive proposal that shifts risk away from customers to the pipeline company, provides a discount in effect for parties that commit their gas this year. You'll see some other features later, but that's exactly what we've done. We're stretching to make the project advance, and we expect and hope that other parties will do the same.
Co-Chair Millett?
And I know you can't answer this, but I guess I would be interested in seeing how far you stretch on that rate of return, because I can only imagine with the flood of natural gas in North America that I don't know what your threshold will be for rate of return, but I can imagine at some point you're going to stop because you need to make a rate of return. And are you worried what's your threshold? Are you confident at that rate of return that you're comfortable with that you don't have to adjust anymore, or could you adjust anymore, or?
Co-Chair Millett, through the chair, You won't be surprised to hear that pipeline companies like a high rate of return.
No, I'm shocked.
On the other hand, we want to see a project proceed. And you're about two slides ahead of me. You'll see the numbers shortly, but we think we've stretched considerably. Certainly, we're proposing a lower rate of return on this project than many U.S. pipelines have today for operating pipelines. So we think we've stretched a very long ways to make this a highly attractive, competitive offer for potential customers. You'll see those numbers very shortly. With that, I'll shift to slide 7. We do think we've got a comprehensive, incredible, and competitive open season plan. I won't reiterate for you TransCanada's and ExxonMobil's expertise. I think that's well known to the committee and to Alaskans. I'd be pleased to give you a two-day presentation on that if you wish, but I don't think you want to hear that from me today. I would highlight for you that it's important that people understand that it's not just engineering expertise that we bring to the table. We move interstate and interprovincially natural gas. And so parties that look at this project and compare us with other parties need to not just look at our engineering expertise, but also look at, can we get the regulatory approvals on a timely basis to advance the project? That is a differentiating factor. We have $17 billion worth of pipelines under construction now in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. No other party has that. We move 20% of North America's gas every day and 2/3 of Canadian gas. No other party does that. And I would be happy to match up ExxonMobil's expertise in gas treatment plants with any other party on the globe. So I'll just highlight that for you. In addition to the significant work that has been conducted in the past that we've brought to the table, ExxonMobil, of course, brought the producer study that was conducted in 2001 to this project, where that has been used as a basis for us going forward. And the team that Mr. Pike leads has conducted more than 250,000 hours of work to conduct and complete that application we made on Friday. Significant amount of work to go forward. And certainly, as we've come together and done all that work, we have a better understanding of the project, costs, complexity, and scope. And now we're on to the slide that Co-Chair Millett was very interested in, and that is addressing how we, as the project, have responded to competition. These proposals are only available to parties that commit their gas in this initial open season. So we're offering a discount, as it were, for parties that commit their gas now, this summer. And we're doing so to try to advance the project on an expedited basis. We have, as I've described, have a comprehensive Alberta and Valdez options. We've had extensive discussions with shippers, and we've tried to be responsive to them. They requested a 48-inch, 3 BCF a day pipeline to Valdez. That's what we designed. You'll recall that there were parties 2 years ago that said that TransCanada was requiring all the gas to go into our system at the Alberta Hub. And they were concerned about that. We've now allowed other customers to get off the pipeline system upstream of the Alberta Hub and move it on other existing infrastructure to market. I think that there are inherent advantages to going to the Alberta Hub. That's a highly liquid market where you can sell your gas. However, customers are no longer required to do that. If they wish to go off upstream of the hub, they can do so. Next, we had listed a 25-year minimum contract term for customers in the initial open season. We now say you can go as low as a 20-year minimum contract term. Once again, you won't be surprised to hear pipeline companies like a longer-term contract. So when we concede to 20 years, that's a concession. Next, we've offered short-term services, interruptible, overrun, and park and loan services. Those are available to Alaskan customers, to customers at Valdez, to customers that want to go to Alberta. Also improves the offer. And the last bullet in this section says shared development costs. In our AG application, we had indicated that if either the customers or the pipeline company terminated the project, the customers would have to pay all the development costs. Now, in the event the pipeline terminates, we're going to share those development costs. That's also a concession that we've made as a result of discussions with customers. The next bullet addresses the issue of the discount that we propose to provide in this initial open season. And that is a reduction in the tolls of $500 million per year for 25 years. So compare that with the $500 million that the state is putting forward one time for the AGEA contribution. We're proposing on a competitive basis to improve the tolls by $500 million per year for 25 years. So that's, if you take a 20-year contract, that's a $10 billion improvement. If it's a 25-year contract, that's a $12.5 billion improvement. As I described to Co-Chair Millett, in our AGEA application, we had a formulaic approach for return on equity that, at the time, yielded a 14% return on equity. We've now proposed a fixed number of 12%, 12.0%. In our AGEA application, we also expected that we would recover our capital through depreciation over the life of the initial contract, so for 25 years. We would recover 100% of the initial capital through depreciation. You can see that now we're only going to recover 80% of our initial capital over those contract terms. So if you take 20 years, we'll recover 80% over 20 years. If you take 25, we'll recover 80% over 25. Those two items lower the toll by $500 million per year. And some would say, in fact, someone suggested yesterday at another committee, that somehow we're not taking any risk with that second factor. I will assure you we're taking significant risk with that second factor. We're saying that 10 years from now, if all things go well, we'll be in service on this project. And if you look at the initial contract terms being 20 or 25 years, that means in 2040 or 2045, we're taking the risk that there will be additional gas available to put in this pipeline. And I will tell you, we're confident that that will be the case. But we're also taking the risk that the market price for gas will be such that parties will want to ship on this gas. And we're taking the risk that we have not got a high cost on this project so that it remains competitive. It's a risk that has been shifted away from customers to the pipeline sponsors. And the third item here doesn't hit the $500 million a year, but will hit the value for expansions is, in our AGEA application, we'd indicated a 60-40 debt-equity ratio for expansions, and we're now proposing 70-30, and I think this committee knows well that the lower the equity ratio you have, the lower the tolls, and certainly, once again, pipeline companies prefer a higher equity ratio. We've proposed 70-30 now.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, thanks for being here. On the 80% capital recovery that was originally 100%, without divulging anything that's obviously confidential information, can you tell us what was your driving force? Because I remember that being pretty set. What
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, for both that item and the return on equity, it was negotiations with customers and the competitive position of this project relative to other projects to compete in the marketplace in the lower 48 and in global markets. So we made a concession and said, can we be more competitive to make this project succeed? We've done so, and we've done so on both those factors and shifted risk from customers to the pipeline company.
Thank you.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll go to the next slide. I'll try to go quickly through this slide because I think this committee understands this project quite well. You've certainly had a number of hearings. I'll just go through it very quickly. The pipeline from the North Slope to Alberta is 4.5 BCF a day. You can see it's 1,700 miles. It used to be 1,715 miles, so our engineers have cut 15 miles off the pipeline route as a result of the work they've done. Once you're into the Alberta hub, of course, you can go to major markets across North America from Boston, New York, through the Midwest, all the way to the Pacific coast. And I described for you as well that you can get off upstream into other Canadian pipelines if that's your choice. The pipeline from North Slope to Valdez, as requested by customers, 3 BCF a day, 48-inch pipeline, 800 miles. It would be moved through the gas treatment plant and a pipeline to Valdez and then converted to LNG in a facility to be built by others. We don't profess to be experts in the construction of liquefaction plant or ships to take it to market in the lower 48 or the international markets. The parties that are looking at that alternatives are very sophisticated players, be they either North Slope producers who are large players in the global LNG market or other players downstream. They're fully capable of doing that for themselves if they wish to go with that alternatives. Both options, of course, include opportunities for Alaskans to take gas off the project. You can see that we have a minimum of 5 offtakes, and for those parties that don't that are citizens that are not familiar with it, like the committee is, an offtake is strictly a delivery point off the pipeline in Alaska. A world-class natural gas treatment plant, a massive plant, really, one of the largest facilities of its kind in the world. And I will tell you, after working with ExxonMobil, we discovered that TransCanada's conceptual design that we had put in place 2 years ago, as required by AGEA for the gas treatment plant, we had assumed 2 sea lifts to complete that, getting those modules to the North Slope. Our expert partner has indicated that it will take 3, and because you have a very limited weather window in the North Slope, I think you probably know that better than I do, and so to get all of those facilities delivered to the North Slope from either the lower 48 or international markets will take 3 sea lifts. The gas treatment plant is the critical time constraining factor on this project, not the pipeline. So that's the reason for the shift in the schedule. And lastly, a 58-mile transmission line connecting supplies from Point Thompson Field to the plant. We will offer that service, of course, to parties that have gas at Point Thompson. We wouldn't expect parties that have gas at Prudhoe Bay to want to nominate service on that system, and there'll be a charge for that separately from the charge on the other system. So to go to slide 10, I'll walk you through the numbers. I'll try to do so quickly, although they are very important. You'll see a capital cost range for this project, and I will tell you that all the numbers on this page are in $2,009. So you have a capital cost range of $32 to $41 billion, and I've noted from the newspaper coverage that some people immediately go to the top of the range. I will just tell you that this is the full range. TransCanada and ExxonMobil believes that we can complete the project within this range. That doesn't mean we're at $40.99 billion. We have a full range of possibilities here, and we think we can do so within this range. The target in service date, you can see, is 2020, and I want to address the tariffs. So the tariffs, including fuel to the Alberta Hub on this case, and I'll shortly show you the Valdez option, is $2.80 to $3.50. And I wanted to put right under it the Alberta Hub price. You know that I've shown you in the past U.S. Department of Energy forecasts. I've done that again. I'll show you on the next slide their forecast that was completed in December of 2009. So it's their 2010 forecast. It accounts for all the additional shale gas and other gas that's coming into the lower 48 expected over time. That's their current forecast. I'm not suggesting to you that that's perfect, just like no other forecast is perfect. But that is a consistent set of forecasts that I've presented to you since the AGEA application. Take the Alberta Gas Hub price of $6.25 to $7.65, deduct the tariffs, you have a net back in the order of $3 to $4 per MMBTU in the 2020 to 2030 time frame. I'll just, if I might just complete my thought before the question, that in our view makes the project technically and commercially viable, based on the current project cost estimates as well as price forecast. It will be up to customers this summer to decide whether or not that netback is acceptable to them and whether or not this is the preferred case. And let me just do one final point, is that $3 to $4 translated into billions of dollars for parties that think in that fashion rather than a netback. And a netback is simply market price less the tariffs. And from that netback, producers must pay their own costs, take their profits, and share with governments. So if you take the $3 to $4, multiply it out by the volume for 25 years, that's something in the order of $120 to $150 billion of margin. And customers will have to decide if that's a sufficient margin for them to commit their gas. Sorry to go on for a little while, but I wanted to complete that thought.
That's fine, Mr. Palmer. Representative Ramos?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, sometimes I feel like I'm getting sold this transaction like it's an infomercial, and the deal just keeps getting better and better and better. For those of us at this table that were here for Governor Murkowski's swing in the batter's box, we talked a lot about a worst-case scenario, and what I feel like we just got presented was the best-case scenario. We were suggested to us that the price range would come in below the $41 billion ceiling. We suggested that we would be in service by the year 2020. We don't know what the status will be of that year if we have a conditioned open season, and how far back that will push the program. I'm not convinced that there is a market in the Alberta hub, so I don't know what it means for the leaseholders to actually find a market, whether there is another increment of tariff in order for them to actually find a market to sell their gas rather than just to get it into the Alberta hub. At one point in time, we had talked about Chicago. And then for the gas price, you automatically migrate to the highest price at $7.65, and then seem to blur where we're at with the price in the year 2030. The $41 billion seems to be the $32 to $41 billion seems to be in today's construction dollars, and yet we seem to migrate to a gas price where it may migrate to by the year 2030. I will tell the committee I heard part of this presentation in Senate Resources yesterday, so I'm heard some of it. So I'm just trying to digest, you know, a very complex presentation by an extraordinary individual, and I applaud you for your patience with, you know, a tedious legislator and legislature and legislator. And so what I'd like for you to do is, if you could just restate that information for me and give me the worst-case scenario so that I can get it like that. What happens if we do peg out at the highest price? What happens if we have one or two open seasons that fail? What becomes the in-service date? How much is it going to cost a leaseholder if they're looking for a market, which could be the Chicago market? And what is that margin if it's the Chicago market and we're on the lower range of the estimate by the Department of Energy? And since they don't have a very good track record, what would it be if it's the Department of Energy minus $1, so that we can have so that we can bracket your best case scenario with the worst case scenario? If you could kind of walk me through that, please.
Representative Ramis, through the chair, a lot to respond to there in that commentary and questions. Let me try to have a go at it for you. Firstly, I hope I have not been trying to sell this to you. I hope that over the years I've been trying to represent our best estimate as to what we believe it will take to advance this project and what we will do as a company to advance this project. But I've also indicated to you that we need cooperation from other parties to succeed. I'll repeat that again today, is we need cooperation from other parties, including the state of Alaska, for this project to succeed. So what you have here is our best estimate, not best case, our best estimate of the cost range for this project, $32 to $41 billion. That's our best estimate. I'm not going to provide you with a worst case alternative, because quite frankly, we haven't done it. We're just like we haven't done a best case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my question. And if I can't get an answer to the question, then I would conclude my interest in your answer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ramis, to the chair, if I may be allowed to respond to the commentary and the question that was placed to me, I'd be pleased to do so.
You just said you weren't going to answer my question, Mr. Chairman, with all due respect.
Representative Ramis, I want to give Mr. Palmer a chance to finish his comments.
How about asking Mr. Palmer to answer my question? That would be helpful, Mr. Chairman.
I'll consider that as a follow-up, Representative Ramis, on your behalf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to try to respond to some of the numbers that Representative Ramis wanted me to review. If you take that capital cost range, which is our best estimate, it produces a tariff range of $2.80 to $3.50. I believe he wanted me to then take the Alberta Hub gas price, as estimated by the Department of Energy, and take the lower end of that gas price range of $6.25, And I believe he wanted me to deduct from that the higher end of our tariff range, which is $3.50. That's $2.75. If I do the opposite, $7.65 to $2.80, you get $4.75, if I'm doing it correctly in my head. That's why I said $3 to $4, which I think is a fair range based on the numbers that you have in front of you. But you'll note that I did round the numbers at both ends. I don't believe that it's fair to look at the U.S. Department of Energy's forecast and arbitrarily deduct a dollar. You're welcome to do so. I've provided you with the arithmetic, and I'm sure that you're fully capable of doing that math yourself. Some parties will choose to have a lower gas price forecast. That's a prerogative of customers. They'll do that in the open season. Some parties will have a higher price deck that they look at, just like they do in any merger and acquisition. Some parties will have a certain price deck, and other parties will have others. I can't tell you whether or not this will be the price deck that any producer or other potential customer will use. But this is an independent forecast by the U.S. government, and I've used it consistently in front of this committee for 4 years now.
And Mr. Chairman, Alberta to Chicago, please, the tariff to move our gas to a market.
Thank you, Representative Ramos, through the chair, for reminding me of that. What I've provided for you here is a tariff range to the Alberta hub and a gas price at the Alberta hub. If you take your gas to Chicago, there will be an additional tariff to get there, but you also generally receive a higher gas price when you get to that location. It varies over time, I will tell you that. It is often equal to the transportation costs between the Alberta hub and Chicago, but it is not always the case. Sometimes it is higher and sometimes it is lower. So the basis differential between Chicago and the Alberta hub, and I apologize for using jargon, the basis differential is simply the market price at the different locations. Market price at Chicago, market price at the Alberta hub is sometimes equivalent to that tariff and sometimes not. But I think that this is a fair representation of a market price because the Alberta hub is the largest and most liquid hub in North America. So there is a market there if Alaskans choose to sell their gas at that location. And if they wish to go onwards, there's spare capacity on existing pipes to go to the Northeast, the Midwest, and California, and the Northwest. Sometimes it's better to move it to Chicago, sometimes it's better to move it to LA, and sometimes it's better to move it to the Northeast. Sophisticated customers, and we have very sophisticated potential customers, will examine those alternatives and choose what's best for them.
Proceed, Mr. Palmer.
Next slide, slide 11, I thought I would just spend a moment having a look at the forecast. I've represented them for you here as presented by the U.S. Department of Energy. I know it's maybe difficult to read from the screen, but the black line, which is, that's the line that is the Department of Energy's annual energy outlook. That's what AEO means. When we made our AGEA application, the latest forecast we had at the time was the forecast that was completed in December of 06. That's the black line. You'll also see the next line is the bluish line, almost on top of the black line. It's the forecast completed in the fall of 2007. And the green line shows their forecast spring of 2009. The reason they don't have one for December of 2008 is because they have in fact indicated that they're not confident of the results of that forecast. And the last line, the most recent forecast, is the red line. The red dotted line shows their forecast completed in December of 09. I'll just, for the convenience of the committee, I've done an arithmetic average of their estimated gas prices from 2020 to 2030. The black line completed when we did our AGEA application had $6.19. The one the next year had $6.33. The green line completed in the fall of, spring of 2009 had $7.64. And the most recent forecast has $6.79, some 60 cents higher than the forecast that they had produced prior to our AG application. The next slide calculates the same, it does exactly the same thing for the Valdez alternative. Here I've provided a capital cost range of $20 to $26 billion, once again best estimate, targeting service of 2020, and a tariff range, once again, to get out of the pipeline at Valdez, so of $245 to $315. This does not include the cost of liquefaction or the cost of ships to get you to market, other than in U.S. LNG markets or in international markets. I've tried to use a common price location of the Henry Hub, which is in Louisiana, for a proxy for lower 48 markets. But I will tell you that if you are delivering into the Costa Azul existing gas, regas terminal in Baja, Mexico, and wanting to come back up into San Diego or to the LA market, the $6.75 and $8.15 is too high. Most parties would tell you that you need to deduct about 75 cents an MMBTU from those numbers if you're going into the Costa Azul hub today. And secondly, of course, I had to examine whether or not this project is viable to the Asian markets. And that's why I've represented for you here the Department of Energy's forecast of oil prices, which are very high, in fact, relative to gas prices. And you'll see that in the next slide. Because to date, gas LNG prices in Asia have been priced off an oil equivalency basis, adjusted to some degree, but off an oil equivalency basis. And any potential customer that is looking at this alternative will, of course, have to judge whether or not that will continue to be the case 10 years from now and for 20 or 30 years after that. They're very sophisticated parties. I'm confident they will do that. If I turn to the next slide, you will, in fact, see just how distinctive and different the Department of Energy's oil price forecast has been over the last year relative to its previous forecast. You can see the divergence, the black and blue lines completed forecast in December of 06 and December of 07 are significantly lower in the $60 to $80 range, and you see that their newer forecasts are well above $100. And if I just compare, I'll just flip back to the gas prices so you can see there is not the same divergence in gas price forecast between the last 4 years that you see in oil. And some parties would say, and I don't profess to be an expert in this, they would say that they're reflecting the expectation that North America will have a surplus of gas on a long-term basis. But that's clearly, they've examined that. I think what I would tell you is the oil-to-gas ratio last year, and as projected by the U.S. government in this forecast going forward, is at levels that we have not seen since 1982. So their expectation is that the ratio of oil to gas is going to be dramatically different than what we've seen for the past 25 years on a going forward basis. And I'm just reflecting their numbers, not any analysis of that. On the next slide, I'll go to the questions that the co-chair really posed to me earlier as to what are the commercial and regulatory milestones that are needed to bring this project successfully through the development stage and onwards to construction and finally into in-service. So this page will address what we need to do as a pipeline company, and the next page, I hope Co-Chair Millett will address your issues as to what other parties like governments need to do. So firstly, on this page, as I described earlier, we do expect that if we receive bids in the open season, they will be conditioned to some degree. That would be the norm in this type of a pipeline project. So if we do receive that, we'll have to work with those producers and shippers to try to resolve any conditions precedent through the course of this fall. Secondly, we need to move forward with engineering, environmental, field work, and other work to advance the major U.S. and Canadian permitting. I'll just note for you here that we've recently awarded contracts to URS and AECOM for the Alaska field work, which will be commencing this spring. On the Canadian side, you see the parties that have been awarded the work there through a competitive process. We will meet the AG obligations, including the FERC application in 2012, and we'll advance the project in step with commercial and regulatory breakthroughs that are achieved by all parties. So we will prudently manage our money and your money. We're not going to run 100 miles in front of the rest of the project. Our goal is to meet the AGIA obligations and move the project forward in step with the breakthroughs that we all achieve. And lastly, on this page, we, of course, will continue to seek alignment with BP and ConocoPhillips. We've offered that to them, and we'll continue to do so. That offer comes not just from TransCanada, but from both sponsors, TransCanada and ExxonMobil.
Co-Chair Millett.
Tony, can we go back a couple slides? I've just been thinking about your open season plan and your adjustment, your better commercial terms to entice the producers to buy into the pipe. Is this can you tell me about other projects? Is this something that you do? Are you always adjusting your commercial terms and risk ratio for yourselves and for potential shippers? Is that something that's normally done on a pipeline project?
Co-Chair Millett, through the chair, I will tell you that depending on the length of the open season process and the negotiations, they're all done in private and confidence. That's what's unusual about this case. But we often see that commercial terms get adjusted, sometimes up, sometimes down. Depends on the structure of the negotiation and how the project can come together. But it isn't unusual to see a recalibration, but I will tell you that because of the scale of this project, a $500 million reduction in the toll, I don't think we've ever seen that, but this is a massive project, and that's why you see such very large numbers on the table. There is clearly a point where one party or the other can't move anymore, and we think we've stretched significantly to get to this level, and I think that any fair comparison of what we put on the table here relative to U.S. Rate of returns would indicate that we put a very aggressive proposal on the table.
Well, Co-Chair Millett.
Tony, how does this rate of return compare to your in U.S. dollars to your Canadian rate of return on your Canadian pipelines? Is it around 12%, or is it higher, lower, or what's the?
Co-Chair Millett, through the chair, if you're addressing our existing in the ground 50-year operational pipelines that are regulated by the National Energy Board. I can't give you a precise number because I don't recall it for this year, but I think last year it was in the 8.7% return on equity, as I recall. Please don't quote me on that number, but I know that that's in the ballpark.
8 or
9. In the 8.5 to 9, certainly under 9, it was 8.5 to 9 percent return on equity. Recall that that's on a 40% equity ratio, not 25%. It's on a piece of pipe that's been in the ground, primarily the initial pipe for 50 years. The remainder of the pipe is put in service over the last 50 years. We don't have completion risk. We don't have construction risk. We don't have development risk. What we have is operational risk. Now, I will tell you that it's our view as a company that we think we have regulatory risk, and that's why the return is so low, because we're not particularly happy with that low return. But that is official. That's public as to what our rate of return is. I just don't recall a precise number, but certainly I'm in the range when I say 8.5% to 9% return on equity. But if you were to calculate 8.5% on 40% versus the 12% on 25%, you would actually get a higher set of tolls.
Additional questions, Co-Chair Millett?
I'll wait.
Okay. Before we go to Representative Dahlstrom, just as a frame of reference, we have about 40 minutes left, and I think there's a subcommittee about ready to take this room over at 5 o'clock, so we got a fair enough amount of time remaining, but just to let everyone know that we are sort of getting close to the 5 o'clock bewitching hour. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question will be very brief. Tony, you stated that you've offered and continue to offer communication and meetings with BP and ConocoPhillips. What kind of response have you received from those companies? Have you actually had sit-down meetings?
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, there have been no negotiations on the project with regards to equity on this offer that we've made. I will tell you that when We came together with ExxonMobil in June of last year. We commenced negotiations with them in the fall of 2008. So it took us a considerable period of time between the two companies to resolve how we would work together. We have not commenced that stage with either BP or ConocoPhillips today.
And just to follow up, have they stated that they are not interested in having those talks, or?
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, to date, they have not been responsive to our offer.
Thank you.
Mr. Palmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I only have, I think, three slides left, so I'll try to move through those quickly and meet your time contract. Now I want to address the issues I think that Co-Chair Millett was referring to earlier. What are the commercial and regulatory milestones required by the project to succeed for other parties? So producers and shippers, if they indeed conditionally bid their gas, they'll have to work with the project, pipeline project, to resolve conditions precedent. We've heard them say publicly for more than 2 years that they need resolution of upstream fiscal with the state. How they do that is a matter between you as the sovereign and producers. We've indicated here that if that's an issue they need to resolve, they need to work that with you. The production levels at Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson, or any other fields must be resolved with the state and the AOGCC. Once again, we're not a party to that as to how and when that will be resolved, but clearly it's our view the sooner the better. But we're not a party to that. We were asked, in fact, I think stronger than asked, to stay out of those issues when we went through the AGEA process, and we have done so.
Mr. Palmer, we'd like to interject a couple of questions. Representative Millett first, and then Representative Ramos.
Tony, so doesn't that put doesn't that put your pipeline in a very interesting situation?
Co-Chair Millett through the chair. It does. I will tell you that pipeline companies never get engaged in those issues. Those are not issues that we're involved with in the Gulf Coast, in shale fields, or in Alberta. We're not a party to upstream fiscal issues. Now, if that is a condition that customers require in order to commit to the pipeline, clearly we want to see it resolved. But we're not empowered to do anything about it. We have to ask folks like yourselves to decide if you wish to engage. And if you do, we wish you Godspeed that you succeed.
Follow up. In any of those other projects and your other projects, have you ever been under an AGEA license like this before? Where you're exclusive. So it's very interesting, and I would say very unique, that you're positioned between the state and the producers. You have positioned yourself nicely between the two. And although you say it's not something that you're going to be involved with, your mere project hinges on just that.
Co-Chair Millett through the chair. I think you've accurately reflected where we are, and when you say we've positioned ourselves nicely, we've done so in a very transparent and competitive fashion. I want to highlight that for you. But have we been in a similar situation elsewhere? I would say we probably have. Not identical, because clearly AGEA is unique to Alaska, but our pipeline system in Alberta for a very long time had a franchise to serve Alberta customers. That went away many decades ago, but originally we had that franchise. We effectively had the same for the pipeline across Canada originally. So were we aligned with governments? Yes, we were. Not in the same fashion as you describe here, but clearly in any basin opening project like this one, we think it's critical to be aligned with government. We do believe that that's a critical component of successfully developing a project, not just your government, but other governments. And we've sought that out, and we've worked very hard to achieve that over the decades. But, you know, your question goes to if this is the condition that is required for customers to commit their gas, yes, we want it resolved, but no, I'm not a party to it.
Representative.
And Tony, is there any other government entity that has offered you inducements to, like the state of Alaska is offering you on a pipeline project? Have you been induced into doing any other pipeline projects under the NGA license as we've done?
Co-chair Mallett through the chair. Not identically, but I will tell you that when the Trans-Canada original pipeline across Canada was trying to go forward, you probably won't be surprised to hear that there was a vigorous competition there as well. In fact, it went through, as I recall, more than a decade of back and forth as to how it was going to go forward. Eventually, it was resolved. Producers had to align. Pipeline sponsor had to align. And in fact, in order for the project to be financed, ultimately, because the initial volumes committed were insufficient, the Government of Canada had to first invest money and secondly guarantee debt for a portion of the project across Canada. Now, once the project went in service, it succeeded, and TransCanada was in a position and did very quickly repay that money to the Government of Canada. So it wasn't a $500 million contribution for development costs, but it clearly was a financial backstop and, in fact, a financial contribution by the Government of Canada 50 years ago to make that project go in service. So not identical, but yes, we've had inducements before to advance projects. We had obligations as well in that circumstance, and you won't be surprised to hear that they were onerous as well.
Representative Miller.
So my question to you, Tony, is with these inducements that we've offered as a state, and we start at our 90-10 here pretty shortly, I believe you said August 1st. So at a 90-10 sharing of costs, when do you determine that it's not profitable? And when do you stop? Do you stop when the $50 million is gone? Do you stop before? I mean, I look at the commercial terms that you've already gone in and made it more enticing for producers to come on and ship money. My fear is, have we now put so many inducements and positioned you to a place where you through the AGL license have to go ahead and continue with the project, even if we can all look at it and wonder how anybody is going to ship gas on a pipeline of this magnitude with these tariffs, with the rate of return, with all these things that you've gone back on. So, when do you stop when do you give up? When's the white flag if the project's not what it's all cracked up to be?
Co-chair Millett through the chair. I want to clarify that I believe that we have improved the terms. I think that's what you're reflecting relative to what we put forward in AGEA. There are provisions, I know that Representative Ramris made reference earlier to the state perhaps wishing to withdraw. There are provisions, as I described to Representative Ramris, for both parties to withdraw under certain circumstances. We can't do that unilaterally. However, if either the state or TransCanada determined that the project were uneconomic, there are provisions under which you can go through a procedure to terminate the relationship. You've seen that we don't think that's the case today. We're here in front of you today after significant changes over the past 2 years in the world, in the gas business, and on the project. And we're here telling you that we believe it's economic, and we're investing our money on that behalf, not just your money, but our money. And in fact, just to give you some numbers for your reference, we've expended something in the order of 60-some million dollars since the license was granted through the end of December of this year. To date, we have received $1.1 million in reimbursement from the state. Now, I don't point fingers at any party for that. It has taken a considerable period of time for the administration and TransCanada to resolve how our computers can talk to each other and make that work financially. And we've that takes us through the end of Q1 of 2009. We've submitted Q2, and we fully expect Q2 to be reimbursed to us expeditiously, and then Q3 and therefore onwards. If we see, and I would expect if the state sees, that this project is no longer economic, that's not what I believe today, but if we see that, we do have a vehicle to terminate. That's not what we anticipate today. In fact, I'm highly encouraged by what we see today after those significant changes that we think it's still viable. That's, I've heard skepticism, not just here, but I've heard skepticism before from other parties. Doesn't shale gas change the game? Doesn't the financial crisis change the game? Doesn't the increased cost change the game? If you look at the numbers that I've presented for you today, and they are our best estimate, that's what we believe as a company, it's what Exxon believes as a company, we think the project makes sense. Now we're going to get further information, good market information from customers in 6 months as to whether or not they also agree with that. If they don't, and no one commits any gas, there are no bids, zero, then we'll all have to look at the circumstances at the time. But we're obligated under AGEA to continue with the project unless we feel it's uneconomic. And even if we feel that, we need your agreement to terminate, or we go through arbitration. That's the structure you set out in the statute. We cannot unilaterally withdraw, just like you can, except under certain circumstances. So we intend to continue with the project. We think it's viable. And as we sit here today, we intend to prosecute the project. We are going to work very hard with other parties to try to achieve these milestones.
Representative Ramis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was at a presentation by Craig Hames, a year ago, 2 years ago, and a very famous Alaskan at the time got up and made a speech and said, thank God for Exxon. And I hope that when we're all said and done, Tony, that I say thank God for TransCanada. I hope that that's the case. And of course, you know from my previous remarks that I believe that the most expedient way to get there is actually to go to arbitration and for both sides to withdraw and to unplug AGEA, which I find to be a Gordian knot and incendiary, and for all five of the parties to get together and revisit this. And maybe after November, when the governor is reelected or when we have a new chief executive, for the state of Alaska, whatever the case may be. And that's what I hope and believe will lead to the most expedient way for Alaska to monetize its gas in a large diameter gas pipeline. In the meantime, I would like to ask you about AOGCC and the amount of allowable production and something that I've heard that hasn't come up in this meeting, which is that you can only nominate gas into either the Alberta or either into the Valdez line or into the Alberta line, and I'd like to hear about that in the context of how large the gas conditioning plant is. I understand the inlet is 5.5 BCF. What's coming out the other side? What would the conditioning plant be sized down? How does the nomination into one project or the other project go, the Valdez project or the Alberta project? What's the likely cost of the LNG facility and the cost of tankers on the Valdez side? If you can just kind of speak to that broadly.
Representative Ramis to the chair. Please, sir, I will try to respond to your questions, but if I don't get a response to all of them, please come back to me on them. With regards to the Valdez option and the Alberta option, you can see that we have a design here for 4.5 BCF a day to Alberta and 3 BCF to Valdez. We don't believe, and certainly our discussions with other parties have not indicated that other parties believe that there's 7.5 BCF a day of volume to be committed for 20 or 25 years for both projects. So that's why I've indicated that I think it's an either-or, that either customers will choose Alberta or they'll choose Valdez. And we do think there's sufficient volumes for either of those cases. With regards to the gas treatment plant, you're correct, is that there will be a larger volume at the inlet side of the gas treatment plant, both for the Alberta option as well as the Valdez option. And the volumes to go through the pipeline in the Alberta case is 4.5, and then the Valdez option is 3. So the volumes into the gas treatment plant will be significantly higher because you need to remove something in the order of 10 or 11% CO2 that's in the Prudhoe Bay gas. Some other impurities as well, but there's a volume differential in a ballpark number that you need to address. Can I ask you to repeat your other questions, please?
I think the either or. I think, frankly, you covered a lot of the questions that I had. The other part of it is just my editorializing about going toward arbitration, but we've already been down that road. And I no need to go there again.
Thank you. And I'll just follow through here. Customers will need, of course, to arrange downstream transportation, secure final gas markets, and if they intend to export the LNG, they'll have to get export permits, either use what they have or find new export permits from the U.S. Government. So what does the state of Alaska need to do? Counterpart, of course, to where the producers are on upstream taxes or production issues with producers, and of course, we need you to continue to facilitate project permitting. You've done so to date. We need you to continue to do that. On the U.S. government side, with FERC, they have established an $18 billion loan guarantee. You will recall that through the Senate Energy Committee last year, they passed a proposal to increase that federal loan guarantee to $30 billion, and they also proposed to give access to the Federal Financing Bank. If that were passed into legislation, that would lower the interest rate for the project, that would be passed through in the tolls, and would have a lower toll than what I've provided, and also, of course, it would make the project more competitive for us all, and better netbacks for producers, and ultimately for tax collector being the state of Alaska. That's clearly in the venue of the U.S. federal government as to whether or not they wish to move forward. That's what I mean by terms and conditions. We also need them to facilitate the project planning. They have started that process with FERC and will continue down that path. The Government of Canada, Alaska Natives, Canadian First Nations, and other parties, we also need them to facilitate project permitting and to align with the project. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will summarize my presentation. We believe we will be holding the open season from May to July of this year. Certainly we'll do so if FERC approves our plan, and we're confident that will occur by the 1st of April. We are offering improved commercial terms versus AGIA, something in the order of $500 million per year. We do believe both the Alberta and Valdez options are viable today, commercially and technically. However, regulatory and commercial breakthroughs are required by us as a pipeline project, producers, shippers, and governments, plural, to make this project a success, to move it beyond the development stage and into construction. We think that the three parties working together, TransCanada, ExxonMobil, and the state, through the AGIA structure, does provide the best opportunity to align all stakeholders and to succeed with the project and capture benefits. And I would only tell you that I will repeat what I've said many times before. It's time for us all to come together and move this project forward to success for Alaskans and for North American and international markets. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would just highlight for you on the last page, I've indicated what our website is. There's a tremendous amount of information there, both the FERC application as well as fact sheets and presentations that's available to the public and to this committee and other legislators. Thank you for your attention today.
Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Palmer. Questions or comments, committee members? We've got about 20 minutes left if you want to.
I've got about 20 minutes for the comments, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I've got 19 minutes worth of time, sorry.
Lucky for you, Tony.
Not seeing or hearing anything more, thank you again, Mr. Palmer. And Representative Peterson.
I just thought I'd throw some information out there. Just I've been reading about some problems that shale gas developments have been having. It takes a lot of water for the fracturing, and there's been some problems in upstate New York, I understand, and there might be the Attorney General from the state of New York getting involved in this. There's some worry that there could be some contamination in drinking water when this fracturing takes place under high pressure, and so at this point, we can't see into the crystal ball into the future to know how much of this shale gas will actually be developed. We know there is a lot of shale gas deposits out there, but we don't know exactly what is going to happen in the future with maybe some legal problems, we'll call them. And maybe Tony has got more information about that than I'm able to present, but
Representative Peterson, through the chair, I certainly don't profess to be an expert in that area, but I'll just make perhaps a couple of comments on what you said. Is no question, the volumes of shale gas that is available in the marketplace is huge, and actually included in these forecasts that I presented to you today. A number of cards to be played out, both positively and negatively, I think, going forward. You described some of the potential negatives. There are certainly potential positives as well. Technological breakthroughs have brought us to the point we're at today, and perhaps we'll continue to advance additional volumes. On the flip side is, you've described some downsides which may restrict the volumes of gas that will come out of those shale fields, because they do take a tremendous volume of water in most cases, and there's environmental concerns by some parties. But those cards are all to be played out in the next few years.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Co-Chair Millett, not seeing any. Thank you, everyone, and we'll adjourn the meeting at 4:41.
Thank you.